From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Horror stories abound of homeowners associations nitpicking over paint colors, dinging people for landscaping choices they never submitted for approval, even fining property owners to the point of bankruptcy. In one North Carolina town, homeowners found their cars towed with no warning from the HOA, which has since apologized and admitted the move was wrong. That's according to WSOC in Charlotte, which also tells the story of Congressman Robert Pittenger of North Carolina suing a would-be neighbor over the size of that neighbor's home, which is under construction. Pittenger alleges the HOA never should have approved the plans near the Quail Hollow Golf Course in Charlotte. WRTV reports an Indiana homeowner is selling and moving over a spat with her HOA about the goldfish ponds in her driveway. Pulte Homes in South Carolina is fining a homeowner $25 a day for flying the flag of Israel, according to the Post and Courier. While the disputes between homeowners and their neighborhood associations don't seem to be going away, HOAs are on the rise. According to the Community Associations Institute, North Carolina has the fifth highest number of HOAs in the U.S. That's behind Florida, California, Texas, and Illinois. With us today, Patrick Mincy, a trial lawyer and partner at Cranfill, Sumner, and Hartzog, which, full disclosure, is an underwriter of WHQR. He has represented both HOAs and homeowners in the region. Patrick Mincy, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Jim Slaughter is a partner at the law firm Black, Slaughter & Black. He was the first North Carolina attorney inducted as a fellow into the National College of Community Association Lawyers and served as CCAL's president in 2014. He was also 2016 president of the North Carolina chapter of the Community Associations Institute, and he's the author of two books on association meeting procedure. He also has represented both HOAs and homeowners. Jim Slaughter, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the invitation.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you live in an HOA? If so, what kinds of experiences have you had? If you don't live in one, did you deliberately choose to avoid it? Tell us about it on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Jim Slaughter, you told us about a Zogby Analytics survey that says Americans rate their HOA experiences as 63% positive, saying the rules protect and enhance property values. If that's the case, if most people are happy with their choices, why do we hear about all these stories in the news about the battles between homeowners and their associations?
Well, Rachel, even though the statistics would say that somewhere in the 80s actually find their experience in association positive and that the board generally represents their best interests and the association protects their property values, if you're not in that percentage and you're in a fight with the association, obviously you're not pleased that statistics may say otherwise. And of course, some of the fights that you just pointed out almost seem insane. And of course, they sometimes end up in a huge lawsuit over what to most of us would seem like a rather strange fight in the first place.
The North Carolina Department of Justice says homeowners are sometimes caught off guard by the power of their homeowners associations to assess fees and to control modifications. Jim Slaughter, you have called that notion, that very language, dated. Why?
Only in the sense that until about 10 years ago, we would regularly hear people say, I had no idea I even lived in an association. And the General Assembly and the North Carolina Association of Realtors and the North Carolina Real Estate Commission have changed a lot of documents in the last 10 years. So now the offer to purchase and contract that's filled out in a cell has to say that you belong to an association, what the dues are, who the president is, who the manager is. The same comes up in the mandatory disclosure statement. And so nowadays, many people learn much more about their associations than they used to before they move in.
Patrick Mincy, you don't necessarily agree that the reporting requirements are enough to fully educate potential homeowners.
Well, in my experience, Rachel, one of the things that when a homeowner is alleging that they don't understand or did not understand or not aware, it's consistent with a lot of the same complaints that you see with mortgage lending. And it is a lot of fine print, and there are good statutory measures in place to try and ensure that an owner is fully advised. But I think that human nature is when you're closing on property, you're more often than not eager to ink that deal. And these are considered details until they aren't, when a dispute, serious or not, arises.
Air Force veteran Larry Murphy told a news organization that he had to sell his home at a loss after a dispute with a homeowners association over an American flag. The legal dispute over the flag went on for 7 years. WBTV reports that Murphy placed this small flag in a flower pot on the front porch of his condo. In response, the condominium HOA sent him a violation letter saying the flag was an unauthorized object. And certainly when it comes to a situation like that, it seems like such a minor infraction. And for him to get pushed to the point of needing to sell at a loss, how does that happen? Patrick Mincy.
Well, I think I'm not familiar with that case, but I think just at an academic level, we're talking about people living amongst one another and living together and how they're going to govern themselves and govern their neighbors. These are issues and disputes that are like divorces in a lot of ways. And so I think that you look at a marriage and you can see how it unravels, and fights that are over things that from the outside seem pretty petty become very visceral and very important. That's not a commentary on this particular case that you discussed, but in general and in my experience, when you're not involved, it's tough to kind of, or it's easy to roll your eyes and say, well, that's just not that big of a deal. How does it get to that level? But what you're involved, when you're involved with the litigation that we are, you know, you see how vested these folks are. And in the law, there's oftentimes nothing more serious or important than where you live and your real estate. And so I think that's why you see passions get to where they often get.
Jim Slaughter.
And Rachel, to pick up on what Patrick just said, one of the wonders of the internet is that we get to read about everything that happened anywhere in the world, and we assume it's our neighbor, but it was in some other state. North Carolina actually adopted a statute in 2005 that allows for the flying of the American flag, the North Carolina flag, political signs. And so our General Assembly saw that case from elsewhere and then took steps to fix it in North Carolina.
So we'll get into this mediation program that was, I think, started by the Community Associations Institute in a moment. But first, Jim Slaughter, what sorts of issues really can't be addressed through mediation and are likely to rise to the level of litigation?
I'm not completely sure I understand the question. Is there something that cannot be mediated?
Yes.
Well, of course, mediation is simply sort of an obligation to show up in front of a mediator, a neutral party, possibly one who has experience in this area, and the two sides talk about whether or not they can resolve their case. So truly, any case could be resolved through mediation. There's some that are more amenable to mediation than others, but a mediation is simply an opportunity to talk about how might we resolve our dispute without a judge having to rule on it. So any case can go to mediation.
Are there types of cases that are just more likely not to get resolved in mediation and need to escalate to litigation?
Sometimes a collection of assessments. When you join an association, you agree to pay dues, and that helps pay for keeping the lights on and paying for insurance. And so if the issue is not that an owner does not want to comply, but for instance, they simply don't have the money to pay, that would be a difficult one to possibly mediate. But if both parties are willing to make some sort of concessions, many things can be mediated. In fact, the North Carolina General Assembly passed a statute in 2010 saying that all associations have to make their owners aware of the opportunity to ask for mediation.
HOAs started, as I understand this, as ways for developers to control the quality of a neighborhood that they're trying to build out, the evolution of the neighborhood. They want to keep that stable. Eventually, the idea in many other states is for developers to cede control of the board, which governs the HOA, to the people who live in that neighborhood, the property owners. But that doesn't always happen. Patrick Mincy, can you explain how North Carolina is different from some other states that way?
Well, I can tell you that in North Carolina, and this is more anecdotal, but most of the developers that we work with, on either representing the developer or on the other side of the developer, have established some sort of scheme that they believe will allow them enough time to ultimately sell all of their property and have enough control during that period to do it in a way that helps them sell their property. That's what they're in the business of doing, is developing it. But really, you know, there are, in my experience, probably a 20-year window, it seems to be, that most developers seem to apply before they're going to turn over control. But there can be a number of varying degrees along the way in how soon they may turn over control completely to individuals from the community, what authority and rights they may retain to appoint their own handpicked folks to serve on that board. And it really is literally from community to community different, and neighboring communities are quite different. And you see folks who are don't necessarily understand that why folks down the road living in a different community have a different set of rules. And it is simply a matter of that's the way that the developer has decided to set it up for their own, generally their own benefit as a part of their scheme.
Is it problematic for homeowners to have a developer be in control that long?
As a general no, I don't think so at all. I think that it's an understandable business practice.
And Jim Slaughter, I'm going to ask you the same question when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're talking about potential disputes with homeowners associations, what property owners can do to empower themselves. We have two attorneys with us today who specialize in HOAs, and we want to hear from you. Have you had challenges with your HOA? How did you resolve it? You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of HOAs, handling disputes, empowering property owners. With us to answer your questions, attorney Jim Slaughter of Black Slaughter & Black. He is also past president of the National College of Community Association Lawyers. Attorney Patrick Mincy is a trial lawyer and partner at Cranfill, Sumner & Hartzog, which is a WHQR underwriter. If you'd like to ask your own question about HOAs on this Thursday, you can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, we were talking about when developers cede control of an HOA to the property owners within that neighborhood association. And Patrick Mincy, you were explaining how it really varies from neighborhood to neighborhood. Jim Slaughter, there are not requirements in North Carolina state statutes for developers to cede control ever, are there? But there are in other states.
Well, and there are in North Carolina for condominiums. As condominiums get sold out, the association has to be phased over to the homeowners, but that language was taken out of the Planned Community Act in 1999. So it very much in an HOA depends on the developer, because some developers who are just excellent, they want to build, they want to move on. Some other developers take the approach that you'll get control of this association when you pry it from my cold, dead hand. And because of that, you as an owner or a prospective owner, I would suggest, should talk to people in the neighborhood and get a feel for an area before you would ever consider buying in that neighborhood.
What are the potential problems that could crop up for a homeowner in that situation with a developer who wants to retain control in perpetuity?
Well, it depends, as Patrick said, on the documents. Sometimes developers have a bit of control. Some documents give them complete control of everything. And as a result, if the members want to change the restrictions as to what can be done on lots, or that they want to be allowed to have clotheslines or whatever might be prohibited, the developer can simply say no. And that might not be a big issue for a few years, but sometimes people say, I've lived here 20 years. I did not expect this to go on forever.
We have an email from George who writes, many in my household disparage our HOA for the Kirkwood development. I, on the other hand, have only praise for our HOA. He writes, I believe they keep the outside appearance of the properties up to a certain standard. Also, the HOA is an organization to get remedy for a neighbor's misbehavior. George continues, the eastern entrance to our Kirkwood development had to run through a non-Kirkwood subdivision who had left the road in awful disrepair. The part of the road was not county maintained. Our HOA pestered the DOT, that's the State Department of Transportation, until they fixed the road, which is now in perfect condition. There is strength in numbers, he writes. That road issue is a problem that crops up all too frequently for HOAs. The idea of orphan roads, Jim Slaughter.
It has been a problem. The General Assembly had about six bills proposed this year to take a look at the issue, but none have been adopted as of now. The issue with orphan roads is some developers, and we have litigation going on around the state about this, some developers said they were going to have state-maintained roads. They never built them to a place where they could be taken over by the state, and they moved on without the association knowing about it. And now the association is being told if they want to bring it into the state system, they have to pay $500,000. Which these owners never expected to have to pay. They were going to have private roads, but it's too long. I'm sorry, they were going to have public roads, but it's been too long now to sue the developer. The developer's out of business or they went bankrupt. And as a result, they're called orphan roads because there's no one to take care of them.
And so they have to be brought up to a certain standard to be taken over.
And it's worse than that because if the development was built in 1980, at that time they would have been built to 1980 standards. And what we're finding now is they have to be built to 2018 standards, which are much stricter and much more expensive to develop.
Now, is $500,000 a lot of money for an HOA to have in reserve for things like this?
It's a tremendous amount of money. You can get much smaller than that. Remember that associations are nonprofits. They don't have any money other than is paid in dues, and many do not have reserves.
They don't build up reserves as just general sound financial practice?
I hate to give the attorney answer of it depends, but some associations have really no common elements other than maybe a sign at the front that has a little light on it, and others, of course, could have parks or they could have public land or they could have a pool and a clubhouse. And so depending on what an association has, they either may have a large reserve or they may have none. And unfortunately, particularly after the economic crisis, some associations would love to have a reserve. But a hailstorm came through and destroyed their roofs, and their reserve got spent on something they were not planning to spend it on.
Patrick Mincy.
Roads are a particular flashpoint for litigation. They're obviously very expensive to maintain and repair. One of the tensions that I have seen in a number of cases recently with respect to roads is some expectation, reasonable or not, that at the time of turnover, when the developer is going to convey that property, that the roads are going to be in a condition, and there's an expectation that they're going to be brand new. That's not necessarily something that's reasonable. These are just kind of the tensions that are in play. But roads, I think, in particular, are so expensive and catch a lot of folks off guard. And this is part of, you know, the homework that needs to be done before joining an association is to investigate some of these things, understand the financials and the operation of that particular association before going all in, because you may be responsible down the road for contributing money towards those repairs.
Now, is this something that you could say in hindsight? So we've seen this issue of orphan roads cropping up, and we've seen the burden that it presents for HOAs, the financial burden. As a matter of protocol, as a matter of just sound financial practice, shouldn't then, even if it's a relatively minimal HOA, let's say there's not a whole bunch of landscaping going on, there are a few common areas that don't require a lot of maintenance, but shouldn't some of the dues still be going into a reserve fund to build up if the HOA still owns the roads?
Well, it depends. I mean, reserves are aspirational, and it would be great to have an infinite amount of money there for a rainy day or for a planned project down the road. But what that means is everyone's got to be contributing to it. And so, yes, it would be great if money was piling up, but that also means that everyone in the association's got to be putting money into it. And so that's a tough sell.
Which happens through dues sometimes special assessments.
That's right.
Jim Slaughter.
And the problem you run into, which in terms of the purchasing aspect, associations are always faced with do we charge so much that we'll never have an issue with anyone but that will scare everyone away from buying in our community because we'll be known as the most expensive community in the state. Or do you try and reach a balance, but that may leave you in a spot where you're short on your reserves?
Not so different from the tax question that municipalities face budgeting cycle.
That's right. I mean, I mentioned before that associations are companies, and buying into one is not unlike buying stock into a publicly traded company. The more research that you can do on that company before you purchase in stock into it is probably going to serve you better.
Now, okay, so this idea of orphan roads and the potential financial burdens they can create for an HOA, members of that HOA, is one of the hidden fees that can crop up. I want to ask you about other hidden fees, things that are not disclosed initially, things that could happen to a homeowner who buys into an HOA. Patrick Mincy.
Well, again, I think that there's no one-size-fits-all answer. Every condominium building is going to be different from another, and the unique needs of that particular condominium association are going to be different from a single-family home community. So at the beach, for example, there are condominiums that may have to pay dredging fees, something that's clearly not going to apply to an inland association that has a golf course and a relationship between different other types of amenities.
Some of these beach communities have created special assessments just for projects like that.
That's right. And so Jim can probably speak to, you know, what kind of disclosure is required routinely, but it really is going to be totally unique to that given property because all real estate is different.
It almost sounds like a potential homeowner would need to have his own attorney who specializes in potential problems that could crop up within, you know, that specific community. Jim Slaughter, how do you even begin to protect yourself?
Well, I would never want to say somebody shouldn't go get their own attorney, but having said that, they should not need an attorney, and that's because, again, the laws and the documents have changed a lot in the last 10 years. Even if you're not buying in an association, if you go to buy a home, there is now a mandatory residential disclosure statement. There's also the offer to purchase and contract, and it has places on it where they have to put things like, do you know any problems? Do you know, are the roads private? What are assessments? Are there any special assessments? Are there any proposed assessments? And so it's a rather voluminous list of things that a seller is supposed to tell a potential buyer now, and they can get in trouble if they don't.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation about homeowners associations in North Carolina, disputes, how to resolve them. We're going to talk about mediation in a little while and property owners' rights. With us today, Jim Slaughter. He's attorney and partner at Black Slaughter & Black. Patrick Mincy, trial lawyer and partner at Cranfill, Sumner & Hartzog. You can ask your own question during this live discussion on Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Lenny from Leland, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Excellent. So you guys covered a little bit of it, but I actually own homes in two different HOAs, and I think that the Realtors and Homeowners Association bear a lot of responsibility in making sure that the people come in are at least given a chance to look at the covenants and peruse them. I was able to skim them in both statements. They didn't give me financial disclosures, but at least I knew what the community was looking at, and I think down the road that would head off a lot of disputes that happen when people say, well, I didn't know I couldn't do this, or I didn't know I had to do that. So I think that if you guys want to discuss that.
That's a good point. Thanks, Lenny. Jim Slaughter, what about financial disclosures? So if Lenny didn't get them, if they weren't just handed to him, is that something that he could have or should have requested in hindsight?
And Lenny did what I would recommend a prospective owner do. It's always fascinating to me that I have friends that if they're thinking about buying a car, they will read about it forever online. They will drive a friend's car. They will test drive it. And then someone will buy a home, as Patrick said earlier, without nearly that kind of research. The disclosure statements now let you get all of the documents that were just mentioned from the seller, including the governing documents. An owner has a right to financial documents. You could get those as a prospective purchaser from the seller. And so
Does that mean they will show up in the package, or does it mean the buyer needs to go through this checklist?
Buyer needs to ask for this. And in fact, there's nothing to stop a buyer from, and I would recommend before buying into an association, there's nothing to stop them from talking to people that live in that association and finding out, is there still a developer in the picture? Are things good here? Are you always fighting with your board, or is life pretty happy?
Patrick Menzie.
And there are certainly different levels of sophistication between different HOAs, but more and more, in my experience, are making a lot of these documents available online and running their own websites. So that's an invaluable resource, I think, for any potential buyer.
Darcel from Leland, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like just to mention I have three major issues with HOAs. I do believe everyone should have standards, and saying that, I think people on the board could be very nitpicky. I remember myself being on the cover of the Star News because of the color of my shutters. I changed them from an off-white that did not match with all the other accessories as windows and what I chose in my neighborhood, being the first in this development that I live in.
Well, Darcel, let me ask you, did you submit that color change to your architectural review committee first, or did you just decide to paint your shutters purple?
Okay. What I did not follow procedures, but I did follow up, and as a result, I was going through mediation and even with the NAACP being involved, and I thought, no, forget it. I did not go back to white, but I did go with the standard of having a black shutter. But saying that, I think HOAs can discriminate people living in certain neighborhoods, like I've heard in certain gated communities. If you can't afford the HOA, you can't afford to live here. And I just find that is a really precarious position to take, and especially with new developments, and if it's not brought up front on the front end of what you're getting, but having neighbors who don't pick up trash, I see the value in having an HOA, but then again, it could be so nitpicky that if you don't have someone that look like you on the board, how can they possibly properly represent? And that's one of the concerns I have about an HOA, especially when they say having an HOA will increase your value of your property. And that's such a bogus contention, especially when the market dropped. My home, I kept in pristine position, condition, and still I found that not to be so true. So thank you.
Good question, Darcel. Thank you. Jim Slaughter, that idea that the HOA's job is to maintain property values, but Darcel is feeling more nitpicked and discriminated against.
And if, I don't know the facts there, obviously, so can't give legal advice, one of the problems with having attorneys on is the thought is we must need an attorney. And and I'd like to point out that most people resolve their issues with their disputes without an attorney, and that's because at the end of the day, it is pure democracy. If the developer is no longer in charge, of course, the board has to sit for election, and there will be a meeting every year of the board, and there are elections every year or every other year. You can elect a new board. North Carolina has one of the easiest statutes in the country for throwing a board member or entire board out of office. And of course, if enough owners are unhappy with the documents, they can get together and simply change what the governing documents say. So there are a variety of political approaches besides the legal ones.
Patrick Mincy.
No, I think that the callers touched on something, that the architectural review committees are another big flashpoint, and these don't typically rise to the level of a dispute over something like roads that are very costly. More often than not, they do resolve themselves without litigation. But to push back on the caller a little bit, in my experience, the HOA members, this is one of the most thankless jobs that you can have. These are generally folks who are not on a power trip. They are just trying to do right by their community. They get involved in all sorts of ticky-tacky issues, not because they're trying to
– These are volunteers usually.
These are volunteers.
Fellow homeowners, yeah.
And really are trying to do the right thing more often than not. Do they make mistakes? Absolutely. But here again, we're talking about people trying to figure out ways – to live with one another.
Darcel also mentioned mediation and involving the NAACP. We have a question from an anonymous listener who says, Are HOA communities a 21st century version of redlining to keep these developments predominantly, if not completely, white? Any response to that?
No. I disagree with that.
You, Jim Slaughter.
I'm not sure I completely understand where they are headed with that, but I would also say no. I mean, 70% of North Carolinians don't live in an association, so you can live wherever you want. And then there's so many flavors of associations now. As you mentioned, there are 14,000 of them in North Carolina. It would seem to me that you could choose which association you wish to live in.
Yeah, that's and Anonymous, if you want to write back and explain, I don't really understand the link between those ideas either. But please write back to us at coastline@whqr.org. Yes.
And Rachel also mentioned on that last caller, there is a state statute also that says that owners can attend certain portions of board meetings. So again, if an owner says, I don't like something that the board is doing, they can ask to go and meet with the board and talk about that particular issue.
And I think we've mentioned this on the air today, but want to say it again, there is a mechanism if enough homeowners, and it doesn't even have to be a majority of homeowners, does it, in an association, feel that the board has gone rogue or is not really serving that community, there's a mechanism to oust them. Patrick Mincy.
There is. It's called a derivative action, and not unlike with shareholders who may want to take over in a publicly held company, there are mechanisms under the governing statutes that allow for it. It does not have to necessarily be a majority, but the theory is that those individuals are going to try and step into the shoes of the association for whatever the reason may be.
Jim Slaughter.
And Patrick went legal, but again, there's a state statute that allows 10% of the owners in a homeowners association after 1999 to call a meeting, and at a vote of that meeting of whoever is at that meeting, they can remove some or all directors.
Just 10%. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're talking about homeowners associations and how the governance of neighborhoods seems to be an evolving practice on both sides. HOA attorneys Patrick Mincy and Jim Slaughter are with us today, and they're taking your questions. You can call us on this Thursday, 910-343-1138. Email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back, we're going to hear from Vince of Halifax. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring the world of homeowners associations in North Carolina, and we're looking at ways homeowners might learn more about the protocols and ways protocols might need to evolve. With us to answer your questions today, Attorney Jim Slaughter of Black, Slaughter & Black, past president of the National College of Community Association Lawyers, and Attorney Patrick Mincy, trial lawyer and partner at Cranfill, Sumner & Hartzog. You can reach us on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Vince from Halifax, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Actually, it's Vince from Calabash.
Calabash. Well, that makes a lot more sense. I didn't know where Halifax was, in North Carolina anyway. But Calabash, you're close to the South Carolina border.
Right, right. Anyway, I'm the president of an organization called the ABCPOA, which stands for Alliance of Brunswick County Property Owners Association, and we represent 22 communities, HOAs, POAs, in Brunswick County, 22. And we meet on a regular basis and discuss and share problems and issues exactly of the type that have been discussed on the program so far. And we also have scheduled for October a forum where the purpose is to educate all of the newly elected board members, which, as you know, probably rotate every year, to tell them all these things about the rules of the road and so forth. And one of the main things that we do is we have an individual that very closely tracks the legislation in Raleigh that affects homeowners. And we get a regular update, and we react as necessary. So anyway, and then just want to make one final comment. A lot of the comments that I'm hearing from people, it sounds like, you know, they they buy a house. Now, everything, at least in my community, when you buy a house here, you sign a piece of paper that, and you get a set of rules that you have to follow, and you say, I'm going to follow all these rules.
Right.
Here, including following the what to do about changing the color of shutters.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry to pick on this individual. Anyway, that's all. I just want to put in the plug. So.
Well, thank you very much for that, Vince. I saw you, Jim Slaughter, nodding your head when he was talking about the organization that he's – have you heard of this organization?
I have, and I'm a huge proponent of more information is best for everybody. So I'm happy to hear that there are educational opportunities out there.
And, you know, what's interesting, he raised this issue about educating new board members about the protocols and the practices. And this story that I told in the introduction of this discussion about that homeowners association that towed all these cars within just a couple of hours with no warning. They eventually came back and admitted they were wrong. They shouldn't have done that. There was at least 24 hours notice required. They had done this because it was one of the regulations that was actually in their covenants, I guess, about parking. But they hadn't notified anyone to say you're in violation of this regulation. But I thought that was emblematic of this issue of educating people who are charged with enforcing the covenants and making decisions about fines. How much education is needed, Patrick Mincy, when you're talking about a lot of people who are just volunteers and they just want to help out with their neighborhood?
Yeah, I think that it again, is going to depend on the sophistication and the needs of that particular association. Some of these associations that have thousands of homeowners are going to have a lot more activity, a lot more issues to deal with. And a lot of it comes down to with a relationship with the management companies that are tasked with a lot of these enforcement issues. And it's not necessarily an individual or group of individual board members, you know, calling the shots. A lot of these enforcement issues are actually being dealt with and delegated to a management company. And so I think to Jim's point earlier about information and research before you get involved, I think there's a lot of research that needs to be done on the relationship that the association has with its management company.
George from Leland called in and he said, I live in Brunswick Forest. The developer contractor recently filled in a swamp area to build more homes. They recently built a retaining wall to hold back the remaining dirt. They're telling us that we are legally responsible for this retaining wall if it fails. Is it legal for us to be responsible? We didn't ask for this wall nor this additional building of homes. Jim Slaughter.
Wish we could give specifics, but Patrick and I just don't know enough about the situation. It will probably boil down to, at the end of the day, these documents are contracts that people agree to when they move into a community. And I know Patrick and I would be interested in what was in that document about what powers the developer had to continue to build the community or to do certain things. And so this is one of those situations where it would probably help to talk to an attorney if they want to know what their specific legal rights are. And it may be that the association will have some meetings to educate people on what they've learned about what's going on.
Christine writes, I live in an HOA development of single-family homes in Southport. For years, the dues were low and no long-term maintenance, roads, pool, etc., was performed. Several years ago, dues were raised to account for this, and most homeowners understood this and had no problem with it. Now a group of people opposed to higher dues have seized control of the board, and they plan to lower the dues with no plan for building up the reserves for future maintenance. This is short-sighted and frustrating. Not sure how to make these people get a grip. Any advice, Patrick Mincy?
I don't have any advice, but I would just say, I mean, that's a commentary on the tensions between, you know, you can throw a lot of money to keep a place well kept and keep reserves well flushed out, but it means that you've got to put money to it. And people are always going to have different opinions about how much money should be spent and contributed to general upkeep.
Jim Slaughter.
And this goes to that democracy issue, too, because if you buy into a community with no clotheslines and 90% of the owners decide they want clotheslines, you're likely going to end up with clotheslines, and you'll just be frustrated. I would recommend if it's a sizable association of more than, say, 20 homes, they likely have a community manager. community managers are worth their weight in gold. There are different qualifications and levels of managers, and they could likely tell them exactly what the consequences of that money change will be. And what it may be is that in several years, everyone who's living there will be faced with a huge increase because that money has not been spread over time.
We have an email from Don. He writes, if HOAs are required to file their covenants with the Register of Deeds, what is the purpose of government involvement if these covenants can only be enforced through litigation, and these covenants may allocate risk in an equitable manner?
I'm not sure that it's accurate to say that they can only be enforced through litigation. The statutes do provide for certain minimum standards that covenants and HOAs have to abide by in their everything from enforcement to rules and regulations. But there is a lot of freedom left, as it should be, for people to develop land as they wish and for people to decide on their own how they're going to run their communities. But it is a democracy, as Jim said a couple of times, and democracies can be messy.
Rose from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. We have trouble with our developer maintaining his status as president and controller of the HOAs. He says that it's his ownership in the units at the condominiums authorizes him to stay in charge.
So because he owns certain condos, this is a condominium association, and he's a condo owner of a certain number of units, and so he doesn't mm-hmm. have to cede control. That's his claim? Is that what you're saying,
yes.
Rose?
Yes.
Jim Slaughter,
so
is there?
We're wondering how we can vote him out.
Just curious, can you briefly tell us why you want to vote him out, why he's a problem?
Well, because we've asked for an audit and haven't been able to get it, and his expenses and income just don't quite come together, and he's just very controlling of everything that happens.
So you're doubting the veracity of the financial statements that you have access to.
Exactly.
Jim Slaughter, any advice for Rose?
I believe this was a condominium, was that said?
Yes.
If it's a condominium, again, by statute, the association has to be phased over time in terms of board members. But if the reason this person is president is because they either have a lot of friends or they own the most units, they may just simply have the most votes. Even with that said, I'll point out presidents don't get elected by associations. Presidents get elected by the board. The membership elects the board. They elect the officers. And so there are a couple of routes here, including members have rights to certain financial records. Board members have rights to all financial records. Most associations have audits of their records in terms of their finances. And
they're not required to have audits, though. Is that right, or are they? Does that depend on the association?
It depends on the governing documents. Many bylaws require some type of an audit. I will mention there's a bill pending in the General Assembly this year that would require audits of associations that have a certain amount of money, but that has not been adopted yet.
Thank you so much for your question, Rose. Patrick Mincy, did you want to weigh in?
I would just add that one of the things that we see a lot in the cases that I'm involved with that have gotten into litigation is a misunderstanding of what financial records an individual homeowner is entitled to and those that they are not. As Jim said, I think it's important to understand this before you get into that community and buy into it. You are not entitled to every single financial record. As a board member, you are certainly, but there is a limited amount of information that you're going to be able to get.
We have Christine from Leland. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My question is about the capital account. I know there's an operating account for HOAs generally and a capital account. And the capital account is basically the reserves. What is your opinion about when a capital account becomes very large, let's say $500,000 for 70 townhomes, just as a hypothetical, And so if they become very large, and there are people who have been there since, say, the inception of the community, maybe 13, 15 years, is it something that would be responsible to say, just like, say, you give dividends to stockholders in a corporation, that perhaps some of these people who have been paying since the inception should maybe get a break from their dues, say, a hiatus for a year or two? Of course, anybody who, you know, anytime a house turns over, the new people are always going to pay the dues. And everybody who has, you know, been there for 3 or 4 years, I'm talking about the oldest people in the community who have paid for a number of years, and now the reserves are really and truly somewhat, well, we, I would say, sufficient. But
Jim Slaughter, let's let them weigh in on that. Thank you so much for that question, Christine.
It's hard to know without knowing specifics, and the reason for that is I know one association that has just suddenly, because of some damage, had to replace their roofs, and it's going to be about $2 million to do that. So that would seem an enormous amount of money to have set aside, but suddenly they need that money right now. For this particular caller, I'll point out if they somehow figured out a way that the people who have been there don't have to pay, which you're not supposed to do in a supposed association, you're supposed to treat everybody equally, but if they somehow manage to do that and there's a huge deficit a couple of years from now, that would mean the people who are new to the community are suddenly being hit with a huge amount of money, and they, of course, will say, why weren't the people who are living here having to pay that money rather than we move in and we get hit with a huge assessment? So it does need to be fair, but again, there are concerns like that.
We have an email from Anonymous who writes, our HOA is less than 20 years old, has fewer than 100 townhomes, $400,000 in reserves, all in bank CDs. We also have the guidance of a community management firm. The board has no interest, no pun intended, he writes, in changing anything on our balance sheet. If the board can raise our dues every year, could they instead cut them? Can we change the investment portfolio? Where would we find written governing documents? Patrick Mincy.
Well, I think that the governing documents, starting with the Register of Deeds, are going to be recorded. As I said before, a lot of these are made available online, depending on the sophistication and the operation of the association. The answer is yes. I mean, the dues can be raised or lowered. That is a possibility. But again, it's going to be a matter of persuasion. And the board that is in charge is going to weigh in on that or decide that.
We have an email from Cynthia, who sent a number of emails with links to articles that I can't read during the live show. But in this email, she writes, in many, and I believe the majority of instances, litigation is the only option for those being abused in abusive and criminal HOAs, and homeowners cannot afford it. Then, too, the homeowners are paying the very HOA attorney being used to sue them in their maintenance payments and are forced to pay another attorney to help them as well. Talk about a scam, she writes. And it is true, when there's litigation going on, the homeowners are paying for that in some strange way. It's like the homeowners suing themselves. Patrick Mincy.
It's very costly. There's no litigation that is cheap. I will say, though, that derivative actions, which I mentioned earlier, the statutes do allow that in a prevailing action, the association is going to be entitled to recover fees. Now, I think that to split some hairs there, it's the association that will be entitled to recover those fees and pay for attorney's fees, not necessarily the individuals who have contributed.
Now, when we're talking about litigation, and, you know, we hear homeowners complain, oh, I just stuck a little flag in my flower pot and I got dinged for that, and then it escalated and, you know, daily fines, and then suddenly they're taking my house. The reason that HOAs get so insistent on these seemingly small issues, is this about legal precedent? If they don't enforce that one little thing, like the color of the shutters, then that means they can't enforce anything else? Patrick Mincy?
In my experience, anecdotally, there's a lot of pressure on these associations to be fair to everyone and try and do their best to apply the same rules to everyone. Are there instances where someone gets picked on? Sure. But in my experience, generally, they're trying to do the right thing.
And we will include a link to the mediation program. That's this edition of Coastline. Jim Slaughter, Patrick Mincy, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell, producer Rachel Keith, production manager Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.